Welcome to the Balancing Hormones Naturally podcast, where we offer you actionable steps you can take today to start balancing your hormones naturally. This is your podcast host, Leah Brueggemann. I'm a functional diagnostic nutritional practitioner. This podcast is proud to partner with Aversio Wellness, where there is a mushroom for every moment, especially when it comes to hormonal balance. Their quality and purity is unmatched, but their golden ticket, the reason why I love them, is their high extraction, so that you don't have to take 1,000 pills to reach a therapeutic dosage. Let's dive on in. Okay, ladies, this interview today with the OBGYN is going to be so good. I know that you all have been anticipating this and you've been dying to hear. So I'm excited to finally be able to share this one with you. Really quickly, I'm going to just remind you about our giveaway. And so every month we're doing a giveaway of an Aversio Wellness mushroom product. So you can win your choice of Aversio Wellness capsule and a choice of Aversio Wellness mushroom blend. So I won't influence you on what you should choose, but maybe I will. No, I really won't. So how do you win? You are going to go to Apple iTunes. You can rate and review the podcast. And if you've already done that, just go to Balancing Hormones Naturally. Rate and review. If you've never done that, or if you have already done that and you want to enter, because you can enter as many times and as many months as you want. You can share an episode to social media. So share an episode that you're listening to social media on your story, tag either the podcast Instagram, which is Balancing Hormones Naturally, or my personal Instagram, which is Leah underscore B-R-U-E-G. And if you have a private account, make sure you screenshot what you shared and send it to me in a DM, because otherwise I'm not going to see the tag. And then obviously I won't enter you because I didn't see the tag. So if you have a private account, make sure you do that so that I can make sure you're entered and keep you in my running notes section of who has entered. So let me give you a little rundown of our guest today. So Dr. Nathan Riley is an OBGYN, and we had a fabulous conversation, and I think that he may challenge some viewpoints that you may have about prenatal care and labor. And I hope that you come to it with an open mind, and I hope that you walk away learning some things. Nathan is a home birth doctor and holistic gynecologist living in Louisville, Kentucky. He received his MD from Temple University, completed his OBGYN residency at Kaiser in Los Angeles, and completed his fellowship in hospice and palliative at UC San Diego. He's a dual board certified in He is dual board certified in allopathic medicine and brings in tools from other modalities like functional medicine and nutrition. He uses exercise science, medicine, lifestyle coaching, and midwifery to optimize the care of his clients. A side note, I want to know if you say midwifery or midwifery, because I was looking into this, and midwifery is what you say in American English, but midwifery is British English. So I would love to know what you say. Anyways, he advocates for and supports out-of-hospital birth along with upholding the midwifery model of care, which he believes could and should be the default birthing option for 85% or more of women in the United States. Nathan is married to his high school sweetheart, and they have two beautiful little girls, the second of whom was born at home. So I know you're going to love this.
All right, ladies, so we're going to dive in talking with Dr. Nathan Riley, and I have so many questions that the ladies from the Facebook group have, all things birth, preterm labor, all of the things, and so I'm just going to dive right in, but I want to start the conversation off with talking about strep B, because one thing that I really love about you and what you have in your podcast and what you have in your content that you put out on social media is that pregnancy is not a medical disease. And so I really want to talk about it from that lens, because I have two kids. And so my first one, even though I live in the holistic world and I did things my own way, I still went with an OB. And it was great. It was a good labor. I had no issues. Everything was fine. And then my second kiddo, I had a holistic OB, actually. And it was again, you know, I still did my own thing, but just the whole situation was completely different just on how he addressed and talked about things. So I would love to just, can we talk about strep B? Like, what is it? Why, you know, do they test for it at the end of pregnancy? Why is there so many things that they want to make you do for it?
Yeah, group B streptococcus lives in your anus and your rectum. It's a part of the flora that allows you to survive. And our war on nature has told us for, you know, at least half a century that germs are bad, bugs are bad. You shouldn't have bugs in you, anywhere on you, that your urine is sterile, that your eyeballs are sterile, that amniotic fluid is sterile, that cerebrospinal fluid is sterile, all these fluids, blood is sterile. I don't believe any of that. I actually believe we probably have bugs living everywhere, and thank God, because they keep us alive. So this group B strep emerges from their anus and it communicates with the vagina, with the cervix, maybe even into the endometrial cavity, maybe even in the peritoneal cavity. Who really knows and who really cares? The point is that when some babies are born to mothers that have too much of that particular bug, and there's probably 1,000 different strains of bacteria living in your stool, when the baby gets into contact with that, the baby who hasn't yet fully established their immune system can get sick. And so about 20% of women are colonized with this. If you were to do a culture, although I'd say probably closer to 100% have it somewhere, 20% are going to come up on a culture. And all that means is that there's an imbalance. There's too much of that group B strep, the GBS. And if you're found to have a positive swab, the next day you might have a negative swab. And the day after that, you might go back to positive. So this is a problem in this materialistic, reductive, dualistic way of looking at things from a medical lens, which is that there's a good and a bad. Bugs are both. They can be bad and they can be good. It's incumbent on us to eat a healthy diet, to get enough sleep, to make sure that our hormones and everything are imbalanced in order to have a healthy gut and an overall healthy body, especially when we're growing a baby. So the concern, of course, is that if you happen to be one of those women who has too much of this particular strain of bacteria, group B streptococcus, that it gets on the baby and the baby can get sick from that and get a blood-borne disease known as early onset GBS disease of the newborn. And that can be very catastrophic, especially for preterm babies. But when a baby gets this on them, it doesn't mean that they're going to get sick. About 50% of those babies will show some signs of illness. Mm-hmm. And term babies have a very, very low chance of dying from that, although they can get very sick and they can be treated with antibiotics and then they go home 7 days later. The issue, of course, is we don't know which babies are going to get super sick and which are not. And mm-hmm. so we treat every single birthing woman as a person who potentially could have a baby die of early onset GBS disease of the newborn, and we just treat you as the average. Mm-hmm. The problem with averages, which is going to be a theme throughout everything we talk about, is that most people are not average. You know, a 28-day cycle is not pretty, it's not like every single client coming through my door. In fact, I don't think I have a single client who has a regular 28-day cycle and it has that for 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. You're a woman, you menstruate, so you know that your cycles vary by a couple of days every single month, and that's not a big deal. That's life. Mm-hmm. So my counseling for women is, what can you do to fall below the average of that bad thing happening? Right. And of course, we're talking about a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. So if you didn't swab at all, the chances of something bad happening are still very, very low, probably mm-hmm. in the range of like 5%. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing. But if you were to take care of yourself and have a healthy gut flora in particular, and skin flora reflects that, and your vaginal flora, your cervical flora, we're even thinking there's endometrial flora now. All of that is going to reflect how you care for yourself and your environment. And if you can fall below the average of something bad happening, then you're going to be better off than what most doctors or even midwives are going to counsel you on.
I truly think that at least one time in your life, a game changer to your health is going to be to use a CGM. I know that you hear me talk about blood sugar balance a lot, but when you use a CGM, when you're getting very objective data, there is no skirting corners. There's no trying to pretend you're doing certain things, because the numbers are right there in front of your face and there's no guesswork. You literally just you have to follow the data. And I have used CGMs before, and hands down, Vary 100% takes the cake for so many reasons. One, they're extremely user-friendly. And number two, it's a very non-judgment based app. It's really easy when you're stepping into blood sugar balance and you're looking at this data. It's really easy for apps, you know, when they're helping you to say things like, that was bad. That was a bad meal. You shouldn't have done that, or whatever. Put things in red colors. It's like glaringly bad, bad, bad. And I feel like that's such a negative reinforcement. And I don't get that at all from Vary. I mean, they don't even use the color red. They use the color orange. So I think that's really, really helpful, because when you're learning something new, it's easy to get overwhelmed, and Vary does a great job of making it a non-stressful experience. I love how they explain blood sugar on the app. I love how they explain insulin and how your body should respond to it. They have a program in their app, their metabolic program, and it really, really walks you through how to get better balanced blood sugar. So not only are you using a CGM and tracking, but their app is literally helping you to get more balanced blood sugar. So there's no guesswork. There's no hoping that you're going to get better in certain areas. They're literally helping you take that data and improve every single day. They're one of the most cost-effective ones that I've come across. So you can join their app and do the membership monthly, where you get a 14-day sensor every month. So you do 14 days on, and 14 days off, and then you keep cycling that, which makes it extremely cost effective. And it also makes you independent, because you are learning. So you practice while you have your CGM, you get your data on your blood sugar, and then while your sensor is off for those next 14 days, you practice what you learned. And then you come back to the sensor and you experiment a little bit more and you learn and you get better. And I just love how they have that set up. So Vary has an amazing discount for you. So you can get $30 off your first month with this code VSM-LEAH, L-E-A-H. And I will also put that link in the show notes for you.
So you're basically saying that their preparation for this, making sure that this is a positive experience, is coming way before, you know, they're even testing for this?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, your health about 12 months before you get pregnant is the most important thing if you want to grow a healthy baby and have an autonomous birth.
Yeah. No, we talk about that a lot. Preconception, nutrition for both sides is so important. And it really, really comes beforehand. So I actually have a side question. This was not asked by anybody. I'm just kind of curious. So I had a friend who, they didn't even do a swab. She said she tested for strep B very early in her pregnancy, like, you know, the first time she had gone in, and they had gotten it in the urine test. And she was saying, you know, that there was all of this information they were saying, like, oh, this puts you at a greater risk for stillbirth and blah, 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 blah. Could you talk about that a little bit? Mm-hmm. And is there something you can do with nutrition? Because that's where she was looking to help support her body, even though they said there was nothing to back up nutrition affecting it.
Yeah, so the concern about a bug growing inside the bladder is that if it is allowed to continue to grow, and what we're talking about with growth is that just like any living form, bacteria, unlike humans and mammals and other, you know, quadrupeds and whatnot, are they have a lot of vital force. They want to grow and they want to divide and they want to, not conquer in the sense that they want you to die, but they're just doing what plants do. You know, these are bacteria. They're closer to plants than they are to humans. So if it's allowed to grow and divide because there's an imbalance in your own, let's call it astral force, which is kind of what differentiates plants from animals, versus the vital force of the bacteria, then those bacteria, if there's an imbalance there, the bacteria are going to flourish because that's what they do. Similar to like dandelions growing up through the cracks of your pavement. Mm-hmm. They're going to grow. So what can we do in terms of the environments in the bladder in order to, again, fall below the average of that likelihood, whatever that number is, of those bacteria growing and then crawling their way up your ureters, which are the tubes that connect your bladder to your kidneys, and then causing a raging kidney infection. Your kidneys get a flood of blood. They are a vital organ in the sense that blood passes through the kidneys at a rapid rate, and the kidneys are very intuitively taking stuff out and putting stuff back into your urine in order to make sure that your electrolytes, it's one of the organs that helps to manage your electrolytes and your fluids, you know, in the body. So if the kidneys get infected, the bacteria then has access to the blood. And when that happens, you can get sepsis, which is what we were actually talking about with GBS. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue in pregnancy is that when you draw a urine culture, they're going to look at it as if you're a pregnant person, and they're going to report on certain things that are different from having a urinalysis and urine culture outside of pregnancy. So if I collect a urine sample on a woman who has a baby inside of her and send it to the lab, they're going to be looking at it differently than a 45-year-old who's not pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to be reporting based on what grows. And what they do is literally take the urine and they swab it onto various agar plates and they see if bacteria grows there. And if you have 100,000 colony forming units or more on an agar plate, you have a UTI. Mm-hmm. In pregnancy, they're going to do a swab and they're going to grow and they're going to look to see what grows out. And if it grows not 100,000, but if it grows any group B strep, you're going to have it flagged on your chart that you are GBS positive, and you're going to be treated as a GBS positive person throughout your pregnancy. And that puts you in a sticky position because, like we've already talked about, from 12 weeks until 40 weeks when you have your baby, a lot changes. You've got hormones fluctuating. You've got dietary changes. You've got sleep and nervous system changes. Your entire body is transforming from maiden to mother. So a lot of doctors, which is what we're told to do from like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, won't even swab you. You already have it. Mm-hmm. And then they treat you as if you have it, and they pump you full of IV penicillin or, you know, some derivative in your labor so that your baby doesn't get that. But what are the chances that your baby is going to get that, especially if it's in the bladder, which we've already described is probably not sterile? It's not like it's a closed vacuum. It's in contact with your vagina. You touch it every time you wipe after you pee, the urethra. So there's an introduction of bacteria on that dirty toilet paper every single time you go to the bathroom. So the fact that you have that in your urine is not all that concerning to me, but it's not my position to tell people what to do or not to do. It's my position to say, listen, this is what was found. Here's the standard of care. What would you like to do? Here are the risks, benefits, alternatives to doing something, doing nothing, or doing an alternative. Mm-hmm. And that's really where I think the clinical expertise of a trained physician or a trained practitioner of any kind requires a little bit of nuance. But unfortunately, a lot of us doctors just like to follow the rules. And that's how we get into medical school, by following rules. We were the kids that were good at coloring in the lines. I wasn't. I've been a troublemaker my whole life. But, you know, you color in the lines really well and you get into the advanced class in first grade. And then you do really well in those tests and you get into the advanced math class in middle school. And it just goes up from there. And it's all because you're used to following rules and you've demonstrated you're really good at following rules. So you're perfect to be a doctor or a nurse practitioner or even a midwife. And I don't think decision making is that simple, especially when we're talking about like IV antibiotics, which can mess you up.
Yeah, no, they can. So let's say then a woman is coming in to talk to her doctor or her midwife or anything. Do you have recommendations so that she can get the most information out of there? Because a lot of times, you know, I know in those situations, they're just given one set of facts and they don't realize that maybe there's multiple sides or maybe there's other places they can look for information and they can educate themselves. Is there anything they should be doing before, you know, this appointment? So maybe research they could bring in or anything to help them.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a program. It's called the Born Free Method. We talk quite a bit about a lot of these topics, but really it's not a matter of here's what's right and wrong. Like there's a lot of people out there that are like, doctors are bad and hospitals are evil and all this. Like, no, doctors and surgeons and hospitals save lives. Like there's no doubt about that. but they're not really great at doing this prevention or even mitigation of disease, right? And just by virtue of being you being pregnant, you don't have a disease. You're just, you're actually healthier than most people if you can grow a baby. So the crux of my answer is that when you go into your doctor's office, they're going to have certain things that they feel are, they feel compelled to recommend and to do to you and for you. But you need to practice saying no thank you if something doesn't feel intuitively right. Now, when it comes to this risk of GBS disease of the newborn, and I haven't even gotten into what can be done in order to help, you know, cleanse your system, so to speak. So I'll get into that. I realize I skipped over that. But the most important thing to remember is that you going in with facts is not going to convince your doctor. Your doctor is going to do the thing that doctors do. They're going to do the ultrasound. They're going to do the sterile vaginal exam. They're going to do all those things until you say no thank you. But I don't think it's responsible for us. Now, I've gone through various transformations and evolutions of my own sort of style of speaking and whatnot. But I don't think it's responsible to empower people with information and tell them you got to advocate for yourself when most women have lived their entire lives being gaslit and appeasing men who look like me. It could be even in the intimacy of your own bedroom. If you're not comfortable saying no thank you to your partner because you're afraid of hurting their feelings, then of course you're not going to say no to a person in a white coat who says, I need to check on your baby or your baby might die. I need to put my hand inside of you. They may not even say any of that. They might just say, we got to check on the baby. They've got a glove on. They have somebody hold you down. And even though while you're saying no on the inside, maybe even verbalizing no, you're going to say, you're going to allow that to happen. And that's going to lead to one of the many things that traumatizes women in this experience. So I think that the big important thing here is that there is no use, I think, for the most part, to say, I've got all the facts and this and that, because the facts are a cloud of, it's an illusion that we know what's right and wrong. And people have this impression that doctors don't know right from wrong. Doctors absolutely know what's right. And in fact, if they were in your position, they would probably do something different or prefer to be spoken to or touched differently. So if you go in and you've got like a birth plan that's whatever people do, like notarizing, like give me a break, guys. Notarizing doesn't mean shit. It's not a legal document. It just means somebody has confirmed that you're the one that signed this paper. That doesn't mean people have to treat you a certain way. That comes from you. That comes from inner work, deep practice in saying no thank you to even your intimate partner and your friends, that movie date. No, I can't. I have work to do or something. Just say no thank you. And that is the start of a good chemistry and good relationship with your provider, whoever that might be, going into any complex decision-making process. And ahead of all of that becomes a remembrance that you actually are the one in charge. I know people have told you otherwise. I know that the tax man, the legislators, the policymakers, your mom, your dad, your priest, your pastor, I know that they've all told you that you're not in charge, but you are in charge. And when you start to assume that responsibility and the outcomes of those decisions, your life changes completely. And that's easy for me to say. I'm a white, straight, privileged, educated male. I get all of that. But there's no other way around it. You have rights, but you have to be autonomous in exercising those rights. So I know that that's probably not exactly what you were hoping I would say, but I do think educating yourself is good. I think practicing saying no thank you is good, and I think remembering your innate power is the best.
Yeah. No, I was hoping you would say whatever came out of your mouth. I think that no thank you is such a powerful phrase, because you don't have to back it up with why you do or you don't want whatever they're offering. You can No is a complete sentence, and you really do have to trust what you're comfortable with. And You know, sometimes I think that is scary when you're in that office with somebody with a white coat and they have their, you know, documentation, and you know, they say all these risks of if you don't do this, this is what is going to happen. And I remember the first time that I did that was when I was pregnant with my first kiddo, and they said, you know, here's your list of vaccinations that you have to get because you are pregnant, and one of them, you know, being the flu shot and all of these things. And I said, no, that's okay. I'm okay. And she looked at me and she's like, I really think that you should reconsider this decision, and just, you know, gave me this whole list of all of these things of, and I'm just inwardly shaking. I'm like, why am I shaking? I just said no. Like, this is, that's the answer. But it can be scary, and you have to practice it outside of that situation, because if that's the first time you're going to try it, it's probably not going to work very well.
I know it's kind of depressing when you see a skincare product and you buy it because it's labeled clean and organic or paraben free, but then you decide, oh, maybe I should turn it around and look at the ingredients, and you turn it around and there's so many toxic ingredients in them that's damaging to your skin, your body, your hormone health, and just your overall health in general. And it's really frustrating because it seems like it's so hard to find non-toxic skincare that's actually non-toxic and actually works. And that's why you're really, really going to love Purity Woods. And that's why I love Purity Woods, because they are USDA certified organic. They are paraben free. They don't have any hidden endocrine disruptors. They don't have any toxic preservatives or synthetic additives. And one of my favorite things is that they have absolutely no scent, no fragrance, nothing. And they actually work. So I first started using them because they use mushrooms in their products, and you know how much I love mushrooms. So why am I not going to try mushrooms in skincare? And it is literally a game changer. I love them. I love their ingredients. I love how they work. And I noticed a difference in my skin using them within 3 weeks. It's so hard to describe a look sometimes, but I just felt like my skin was more plump looking, more juicy looking, more, you know how, I guess, you know, when people say they think their collagen is doing really well in their skin, except for I didn't change anything in that area. I just had changed my skincare. That's the difference, where you just feel like, wow, my skin just looks better. It looks better. And who doesn't want that? We all want that in our skin. Their age-defying dream cream is a game changer because of their maple leaf extract. So this helps eliminate fine lines, wrinkles, age spots, uneven skin tone. And their age-defying night cream has the tremella mushroom, which is more potent than hyaluronic acid. So literally, you cannot go wrong. So I want you to try them out and love them just as much as I do. Turn back time on the appearance of your skin with Purity Woods Age-Defying Dream Cream. Purity Woods is currently offering 17% off site-wide, but we have an additional 10% discount for our listeners for a total of 27%. Go to puritywoods.com/Leah or enter code Leah at checkout for an additional 10% off your first order. That's PurityWoods.com and enter code Leah, LEAH, for a total of 20% off your first order.
Well, I mean, this is a really challenging space. You know, if you leave a woman undisturbed in childbirth, they're not there anymore. And frankly, like, one of the big questions that I think I'm probably, my path is taking me down, is not the whole informed consent thing. Like, that stuff's become easy for me. It's like, where do they come from? Because this woman who I'm watching give birth is not a medical procedure. This is like way more important than that. This is like a rite of passage. There's something magical happening here. And people speak very, you know, poetically about this. But I like really want to know, like, when does this life thing start inside the app? This is like deeply important to who we are as people. There is a baby emerging earthside out of another human being. Like, this is really important stuff. So if we're going to now pepper you with questions and now want you to advocate for yourself when you're not even in your body anymore, it becomes very, very hard to do that for the first time in the throes of labor. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's kind of weird when you are in labor, especially at the end there. I never really know who's even outside of my husband. I am unaware of who else is in the room and what they are doing. Afterwards, my husband will be like, oh, yeah, you know, they asked you a question and you were just like, went right over your head. Yeah, I was like, I wasn't listening.
Yeah.
Can we circle back to strep B a little bit in terms of what you would recommend that they're doing either pre-pregnancy, during their pregnancy to help make sure that, you know, they're supporting their body the best they can?
Yeah. Well, I think that when people use the word holistic, I don't think they use it appropriately. I think they say holistic and what they mean is natural. Like they are hands off, they're low intervention. I guess that's like nowadays, that's pretty darn radical. But holistic is comes from a term, a Sufi term, holism, which really comprises every component that is Leah. Mm-hmm. And if Leah, if I were to ask you, who are you? You're not like, tell me about you. You're not going to tell me what your blood work shows or what your imaging results show, or you're not going to repeat your medical history. You're going to tell me like, well, I'm a person who loves my kids and I'm afraid of these things and I find a lot of joy in these things. And my first orgasm was like this. And like, you get to learn about a whole a person's whole story. You're not going to tell me that as a stranger. But my point is that the lived experience of Leah is not going to be highlighted by how your labs and your imaging have trended over time. Mm-hmm. And so holism requires me to consider your whole life story, the ebb and flow of joy and sorrow and despair and all these really complicated things that we have a hard time putting language to. Love is a really, really important thing. And our view of the human body through the lens of materialism has compelled us as OBGYNs to stay in our lane when it comes to gynecologic health. So I'm a quote expert. By the way, I'm not an expert in anything because I don't have a vulva. I don't have a uterus. I've never given birth. I'm not an expert in any of those things. You're more of an expert than I am. So the vulva, the clitoris, the bladder, these are all supposed to be my jam. The uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries, the pelvis, blah, 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 blah. And people will reach out to me and they'll say, what's a natural remedy or a holistic remedy for this? And I'm like, well, tell me what holistic means to you. And they're like, well, I want natural. And it's like, well, I'm not your guy. Because frankly, there is some reason why your body is developing these imbalances. And it could be physical. It could be something we find on labs. Like you're having heart palpitations because your potassium's off. Fine, let's fix the potassium. How did the potassium fall out of balance? Kidneys? I don't know. We'll have to investigate that. But the point is that your body does not operate, any of the organ systems does not operate in isolation. And this GBS thing is not a birth problem. Your GBS thing is an overgrowth of a particular type of bacteria, as I mentioned, in the intestines, in the colon especially. That's the large intestine. So how does that imbalance come? The guts are interesting. My daughter just fought off a blastocystis hominis infection, and I had to pull out a big gun, something called metronidazole flagyl. We use this to treat C. diff and some other things. It is a big blast. It's a bazooka to your intestinal flora, and we have to focus on rebuilding that for her. But this parasite, you know, found a host in my little two-year-old, and it was just living there. And so one way you could look at this is, oh, you drank dirty water. Probably. I don't know. But why did the rest of the family who's just done the same thing my two-year-old has done for every day of her life, why did they not get sick and she got sick? Well, as a little child is developing their ego and their astral, their etheric, their physical mineral body, and they're starting to integrate all these things. Like they're on a, you know, like in Spaceballs, they're going through like time warp. Their body is just transforming in front of your eyes, but it's not just their physical body. It's these energetic bodies as well. So what can we learn from a parasite taking up host in my daughter when it didn't take host in my four-year-old, my wife, or myself? There must be some barrier there that is, it's permeable, right? And I'm not talking about the intestinal lining. I'm talking about this idea of self versus other has not been fully embodied yet in my daughter. So energetically, we need to produce a barrier so that my daughter can have more of an identification with self and see this foreign invader as something else. Now, why am I talking about all this? You probably think I'm high or something right now. Well, frankly, metronidazole was not my first choice because that's going to disrupt a lot of other balances within her intestinal tract. And as you're going through motherhood, we're looking at this process of becoming a mother, growing a baby. There's a lot of transformation happening. And you sometimes, I think, struggle with friend and foe. I mean, frankly, you're growing a foreign object inside of your body, which is half your partner. There's half of that material growing inside of you is foreign. So how is your immune system able to operate that? We don't really know. And that's really beautiful. But if you consider all of these nuances in the intestinal tract and all these different species that have to be seen as foreign, but they're allowed to live there, we can start to kind of unpack what's happening here. So that's the long answer, is that you need to try to figure out how you're interacting with your environment in order to have a healthy gut microbiome so that these various imbalances don't develop in the first place. If you've got some bugs growing in your bladder or whatnot, you want to prevent those bugs from crawling up into, your ureters, towards your kidneys, things like D-mannose, cranberry juice. Those are all types of things that actually make it too slippery for them to get up in there, right? Fine. Mm. That's an easy fix. But what about this GBS thing? Well, the first thing is, do you actually have to worry about this? I don't know. That's not something for me to decide. The risk is pretty low, but my wife didn't even swab in our pregnancies. I don't think she did in either of them. And our babies didn't die. So that's an N of two. My wife also and I eat a wide variety of high fiber, high nutrient foods. And so we probably have intestinal tracts that are pretty darn healthy. And so again, falling below the average, my wife and I weren't worried about that. We're also not worried about vaccinating our kids because I don't think our kids are going to be injured by bugs any more so than they would be injured by the vaccines themselves. So we like to fall below the average and we like to care for ourselves on a holistic level. Now, if we're to go back to that term holistic, the other relevance to the gut is that when people are under immense amounts of stress, financial, relational, emotional, whatever, it wreaks havoc on your intestines. And if you were to run a stool analysis on me right now and then repeat it in 2 weeks, it's going to give a very different outcome because there's a constant ebb and flow energetically and physically within this makeup of the intestines. So my advice for people is, again, to get started before you get pregnant, and then you don't even have to worry about this GBS thing. But then while you're pregnant, continue to eat foods that you know are going to be nourishing to your intestinal flora. You're not feeding your body with food. You're feeding your intestinal flora. And that is extra hard nowadays because most women are on some form of hormonal contraception, including the pill, which is very disruptive to that whole imbalance. And I bet if we looked at the frequency or duration of oral contraceptive use and GBS, I bet we would see a connection. I don't know that for sure, but I bet we would, because that is probably the number one thing we're doing to harm women's intestinal tracts. And then, of course, they struggle to get pregnant. And then there are all these synthetic hormones and other junk supplements, this nonsense out there that's going to be the six hacks to get pregnant and all that. That further wrecks your gut. But hey, you got pregnant, whether it's through IVF or naturally. And now you're left really to kind of sit with this sick intestinal tract. And hopefully one part of that illness is not that you have an imbalance in GBS. Mm-hmm. So I've said a lot, but take care of your intestines. Like it's linked to every other organ system in your body. And if you have a healthy gut, you're probably going to be healthier for longer than the average population.
Yeah. It's crazy. Everything that comes back to the gut. And that's, I know for a lot of people, not necessarily what they want to hear, because it's like, oh, can I just take a supplement that's going to make sure that I don't test positive for this? But it's, and I'm sure you get this question a lot where, I'll share something that I'm using and they're like, well, is that pregnancy safe? Like, can I take that? Or, and I'm like, well, I don't know.
Nobody
what
knows.
You would want to do. It's like, I'm comfortable doing this, I'm okay with this, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're comfortable with it. And I think even though that is a really hard answer, it really does come down to like whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. Correct. So it's like if you are looking at, you know, XYZ and you're afraid to take it because you're worried it's going to be harmful for you or you're worried about the side effects, I bet you any bucks, like you'll either get nauseous, you'll get stomach cramps, maybe you'll get diarrhea, and you're like, you'll prove to yourself, yep, yeah, shouldn't have taken that, you know?
Yeah.
Our mind is so, so powerful that way. But speaking of all that fiber, I have a question for you. So can we talk about morning sickness? So is this something like mentally I just need to prepare myself that if I can just rewire my brain to not have morning sickness, that's what I have to do? I don't know. Because what are your pointers, especially for women who have extreme morning sickness? Is there preparation we can do, again, pre-pregnancy that can set us up for no nausea? Because that would be great. I would love to do
that. That would be so lovely. Well, let's look at the one extreme, hyperemesis gravidarum, which is not just morning sickness. It's whenever you are not able to tolerate virtually anything by mouth and you are refluxing over and over and over. You need IV fluids, sometimes IV antiemetics like Zofran and these things, which Zofran doesn't work very well, by the way, everybody. It's the fifth most common prescribed medication in pregnancy in the United States. It doesn't do shit because it doesn't work on the right parts of the brain that are causing your nausea and vomiting. But I'll just leave that. The women who have issues with nausea and vomiting in pregnancy likely have some underlying kidney, liver, or thyroid disorder. So getting those investigated is key. Now, the liver, I'm going to get a little esoteric again here, but the liver is the one organ that is being exposed to everything you put into your mouth. Mm-hmm. So it goes into the intestines, it gets digested and absorbed by your bacteria in the wall of your intestines. It goes through the liver, a large portion of it does. The liver sorts it out and then does something with it, right? Your liver is also responsible for cleaning the blood in a variety of ways, what we can call metabolism. Whenever people hear metabolism, they just think mitochondria and they get into all this molecular hydrogen stuff. And it's like, guys, metabolism is the reconstitution of various nutrients in your body. If you've got a bunch of hormones circulating, your liver has to break them down so they can be excreted from the body. Mm-hmm. And your liver is it's a sensing organ that is determining what's going on the outside and helps balance it out with what you need and what's going on the inside of your body because of this first pass metabolism. So when women have issues with nausea and vomiting in an earlier pregnancy, I will generally do a pretty heavy liver cleanse, which is not just a juice cleanse. You actually have to take something after you've ramped up those metabolic, these phase one and phase two metabolism, these CYP3, 4A and 2D6, these different pathways, which not a lot of doctors, you know, to their credit, don't know about this, but I am also a hospice and palliative care doc, and I have to know those pathways in order to utilize opioids, which I don't do anymore, but I got to be pretty good at this stuff. So when you consider how the liver operates, it's like one of the most beautiful organs because number one, it regenerates unless it's completely like necrosed and fibrotic and you've just wrecked it over years of alcoholism. It'll rebuild itself because it's so vital to maintaining these metabolic processes and maintaining the constituents of your blood. But the liver, it doesn't do this just by virtue of being the liver. This is where the nutrients, the vitamins, and specifically micronutrients are so important. And some of these pathways that will allow you to regulate your estrogen and progesterone, let alone all the other junk that's going into your body and trying to get out of your body, the B vitamins are probably the most important. And this is where the conversation around folate comes into play. If you go to Sprouts or wherever, you look at the vitamins on the shelf, and there's like some that are $100 a bottle, some are $20 a bottle, some are gummy, some are tablets, some are powders. Most of them are going to have folic acid. And folic acid doesn't work like folate. Folic acid is a synthetic version of folate. And when you take folic acid, your body is not able to utilize it like you're able to utilize folate, especially if you're one of the up to 60% of women with a variant of the MTHFR gene mutation. I would have guessed almost everybody. In fact, I bet it's way higher than 60%. There's something happening here with this. And I wonder if it's even maybe being unveiled because of our fortification of so many foods with folate. They say folate, but it's actually folic acid. So ever since World War II, we had all these labs making poisonous stuff for, the war, and they turned their attention to fertilizers and things like folic acid to enrich our foods and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have a variant of the MTHFR gene mutation, then you can't utilize that. And folic acid builds up in your body with nowhere to go. And that can become toxic in and of itself. So when I have a person, going back to the client who had a history of hyperemesis or something like that, I will do a liver cleanse. Sometimes I will send them to a Chinese medicine practitioner to do a blood and kidney tonic program in order to tonify how their kidneys are functioning. That will generally bleed into maybe some liver support. There's this concept of qi, and qi can be stagnant. It can be, in abundance in various places. Chinese medicine docs are great at reestablishing that equilibrium. But even just from a functional medicine standpoint, cleansing out the liver with a good, let's upregulate the metabolic processes that I mentioned with things like chicory, dandelion, those types of things. And then you're going to take a binder thereafter because your liver is going to be pumping out a bunch of bad stuff through your biliary tract with the help of bile acids that goes into the stool. But the stool isn't like stagnant either. In fact, there's a lot of stuff there that might reabsorb it unless you bind it up with a bentonite, charcoal, one of those types of things, and then you can excrete it in your poop. You'll notice your poop changing colors. You'll notice your sleep is different. Your mood might even be a little irritable for a little while. You might get a lymph node that flares up. It's all a part of the process, but your body's actually, this is like real detox. This isn't like something that Dr. Mercola has like a new newsletter on that says like detox 101 or whatever. Like, no, this is like really how your body works. I won't get into some of the more energetic stuff around the liver because I think I've said a lot there, but if you can cleanse out the liver, cleanse out, get the kidneys working well, hydrate well, and you can introduce nutritious foods that have folate inherently built into them, like go figure, beef liver. Beef liver will fix almost every single problem in pregnancy alone. If you add to that smoked oysters, bone broth, fermented cod liver oil, and eggs, you've got nature's multivitamin right there, and it's way better than any prenatal. But some of those prenatal vitamins that are circulating now do have folate, things like WeNatal. WeNatal is my favorite brand right now. They have adequate amounts of a whole bunch of things that is an insurance policy to an already healthy lifestyle that should have started 12 months prior, especially if you had preeclampsia or you have thyroid disease or you had liver, some sort of hyperemesis or nausea and vomiting. It all comes back to how are you treating your body and how is it harmonizing with its environment?
Oh. You just dropped a lot of things there. Liver, are they coming to you after they're already having nausea, or are you saying this is something you need to be doing pre-nausea, basically?
Yeah, I just added some content to the Born Free program, which is all about the preconception considerations for this issue. I mean, frankly, it is miserable. And if you're already pregnant and you have really, really bad nausea, vomiting, we're not going to do a liver cleanse. In fact, you really shouldn't be doing that in pregnancy anyways. This is all way before. But as soon as you get that glimmer in your eye, like you want to get pregnant again, do all of these things and start heavily supplementing on the B vitamins. I will tell sometimes people, especially if they're a little bit older, if they have any sort of history of nausea and vomiting, I will tell them, in addition to all of this, even a WeNatal, like get the prenatals and everything, start taking pyridoxine 50 milligrams daily. Pyridoxine is vitamin B6, and that alone will sometimes be sufficient to avoid nausea and vomiting in your next pregnancy. But start taking it as soon as you feel like you want to start trying. And get those levels up. Get your liver cranking out all those metabolic byproducts so you can get it out of your body.
I need to take notes.
B6.
Yeah, B6, get it in. So I'd love to talk about some beef liver. I love beef liver and beef organs and all that good stuff. What is your recommendation or looking into using that as your prenatal, or where should people look to see what they're comfortable with versus doing like a standard prenatal?
Yeah. Yeah. My wife, for the record, you know, I talk big game, but my wife did not take prenatals. And we have two very, very, she had a 90-minute labor, her second one, with like no tearing. I mean, very, very nourished woman. Also very grounded and embodied. I mean, when we're talking again about holistic care, I think considering how we care for ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually is important. But I think that goes the same for how we nourish ourselves and how those animals mm-hmm. and plants are being cared for. So if you want to try taking some of these foods I've mentioned, I recommend finding the highest quality beef liver that you can afford. The good news is beef liver is the cheapest part of the cow. Even at the mm-hmm. most expensive ranch in the world, the liver, well, not in the world maybe, because other countries are a little bit less finicky about what they eat. But if you go to, so there's a farm down the street from us in Crestwood, Kentucky called Fox Hollow. It's a biodynamic farm, which is the equivalent in farming to Waldorf in childhood education, if people understand what that means. But just know it's regenerative, it's organic, it's all those things. These cows are like loved. They are beloved. Their herd is very well cared for. They are roaming around in various pastures all year, and they are just loved on. They try to avoid using antibiotics. I hope that they're avoiding using vaccines, but I know that that's becoming more of an issue with the environmental toxins and cows getting sick. But they're not on a feedlot. These are cows that are not being fattened up quickly. They have a rotation, and the cows are very, very well cared for. And this is going to sound so cliche, but a happy, healthy cow is going to make for a happy, healthy pregnant lady. And that's mm-hmm. just the way it is. So Lily Nichols is a registered dietitian. She wrote a couple important books that I'm sure you're aware of. One mm-hmm. was called Real Food for Pregnancy. The other was Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. She has a blog post on the importance of organ meats, and beef liver, hands down, is the best possible thing you could be eating. The vegans, I don't know what to tell you. You can take extracted vitamins and nutrients all day long from plants and animals, and it's not going to compare to eating the real thing. So I don't have advice for vegans there. But if you're a vegan and you're open to eating a little bit of beef liver, it will change the game. And for the record, I don't take vegans in my practice. I don't attend their births. I just don't think it's a very good approach. And if you're going to be a vegan, to get the immense amount of micronutrients that are only available in bioavailable form in animal products, in order to get those nutrients, like, you have to be very, 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 you almost have to be like a biochemist. You have to really understand these processes, probably even more so than I do. But that's sure as heck a lot harder than just saying, well, I don't want to eat animal products, but this cow is really well respected. This farm is as eco-friendly as anybody. And this cow is a happy cow and doesn't die under duress and isn't anxious its whole life and isn't being pumped filled with growth hormone. This is a cow that, you know, it would be very reasonable to change my diet to get a little bit of this cow's beef liver into my diet in order to get all those other vitamins. So I don't like the flavor of liver. I don't think many people do. If they say they do, they're probably lying. It is very unpalatable, but you can blend it into, you know, ground beef or ground pork, whatever you like, ground chicken. You can put it into soups. You can put it into spaghetti sauce. And I don't even tell people to take stuff out. Like, yeah, I don't think you should be eating bread and cakes and sweets all day long. But even if you did do that and change nothing, adding a little bit of beef liver, a couple ounces twice a week, maybe, it's like almost like a cure-all for almost everything in pregnancy, including your, you know, recovery from C-section, your blood sugars, the risk of you tearing your perineum when you're giving birth vaginally. Like, everything gets better, including your nausea and vomiting, preeclampsia rates, everything goes down. So my clients don't get those things because they're all pretty omnivorous. Very few are carnivorous. Many are omnivorous. And beef liver, I think, is the key. And those other things, but beef liver is probably the number one.
Yeah, get in all the things. I will grind up beef liver and put it in like hamburgers and meatloaf. And, you know, that's an easy way for my kids to get it in too, because, you know, they don't know what I mixed into their hamburger. So
yeah,
that's how we do it. I agree. I do know some people that are like, oh, you can have liver pate. It's so good. not me.
It's a little,
that's disgusting.
A little hard. Yeah. Yeah. You can, I mean, if you use enough seasoning, like there's companies like, what's it called? U.S. Wellness Beef, U.S. Wellness Meats. They make like, it's like Braunschweiger and liverwurst and whatnot, head cheese, these types of things, which sounds so gross to us, but they are basically sausages made with organ meats, and then they throw a bunch of seasoning into it. And it really is quite palatable, even as it is. But if you blend that in with other, you know, beef and whatnot, and guys, use seasoning. Like us Americans don't like to season our food as much as we could. But if you add in a bunch of other things, like all the spices from organic sources, of course, add that in there, and you're getting extra nutrition in addition to this like little bit of organ meat you're going to be adding in. It's just baby steps. Even if it's just one spoonful's worth a week, it's still better than nothing. I won't say that if you're vegan that that's going to be sufficient to get your nutrition, but you know, you're probably going to take a good prenatal vitamin and all of that, but you got to start somewhere. And this is one thing I think us Americans, it's time that we kind of got over it and just started developing an acquired taste.
Yeah, one of those things that you can suck it up. There are some good companies out there that will do like encapsulated. Or I know some people will make their own, basically, like you have to freeze it for so long. But
that's what we do. Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah. We make our own. It's very time consuming. But again, back to like connecting to your food, there's sort of an honoring of the cow. Or if you hunt, like the organ meats of the deer are probably the best thing. Like that's what a real... like a real trophy is when you hunt, is to take the liver and the spleen and the kidneys and to use those, the heart, to then use those in your diet. Like that's the ultimate source of nutrition. And yeah, it takes some time, but it allows you to connect to the liver. You know, it's almost like a meditative practice in some way that does take a lot of time. But nowadays, of course, we have to be productive and it's a waste of time. So order from here and there. The one other thing I'll say about that is that Force of Nature and Heart and Soil, these are great companies. Like I'm not going to knock them, but if we really believe in regenerative agriculture, that is not the way to go. There's a guy named Daniel Griffith who's out in Virginia. He has a really beautiful farm there and teaches around regenerative agriculture. And what we're talking about there requires you to buy from your local farms and to demand as a consumer that this farm improves their practices, because we can't have like this car, I don't know, I don't want to call it a carbon footprint, but it's not regenerative if it's not local. And a lot of these farms, because of demand, have to go around the world, New Zealand, everywhere, to get enough beef liver to make your desiccated beef liver capsules. It's highly wasteful. It's not very eco-conscious. If we want to look at farming as a way of saving the planet, we have to also be doing it locally. And that's, we're just adding barriers. I realize that. But if we talk about the ideal, then we can slowly start to edge towards it, as opposed to saying, well, we can't do that, so let's just not do it. I just don't believe in that sort of way of living.
I mean, that also comes back to, too, you know, when people say, oh, that's not available in my area, or this is too expensive. It's like, well, we make it less expensive by making it more available by, you know, telling our farmers this is what we want. And putting our money there. I know you touched on preeclampsia. Yeah. Can we come back a little bit? Because I know a lot of times if you seem to have recurrent preeclampsia, or if you do have some type of the MTHFR mutation, you can often be told to take a baby aspirin because of blood clots. What are your thoughts there? Or again, preparation for a healthy pregnancy, what would you look into for this?
All right, we have to get a little wacky here again. The human, our Western, our allopathic model, nearly 100% of doctors and nurses and everybody would agree that the heart is a pump. The heart's not a pump. And the reason I say that is that the blood is flowing in an embryo before the heart is formed. I will also say, people are like, okay, he's lost me. He's gone off the deep end. I am also a hospice and palliative care physician. I've cared for innumerable men and women who have something called a left ventricular assist device. And that is a pull pump. it circulates blood in the body. It replaces the action of your left ventricle, which is the big, giant, strong chamber that presumably pushes blood out to the lungs and to the body every single time. Well, not to the lungs, but to the rest of the body every single time your heart pumps, beats. And they go into heart failure due to years of cocaine and opioid abuse, whatever, or some sort of congenital something. They get this thing in place and they will tell you, I don't feel like I'm alive anymore. So what can we learn from that? And if you listen to their heart, by the way, they don't have a lub dub. They have a it sounds like a pool filter. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So what I took from this was I'm looking at this person who feels and looks like a zombie. And they oftentimes become very suicidal. They have a lot of sort of guilt and regret about this, and they'd rather die to have to acknowledge, because it's not a replacement for something that isn't a pump. So then what is the heart? Well, the heart is circulating blood, but it's vortices-ing the blood. It's there is a something magical about the heart that is animated by the blood. It does not pump the blood. It is animated by the blood, which is circulating before the heart is even structurally formed inside the embryo. Now, that makes me sound like a crazy person, and you might be wondering, why am I saying this? Well, preeclampsia seems to be a combination of some sort of toxic something in the blood that leads to vasculopathy, meaning sick blood vessels. And I think that there's something relevant here when we consider that blood is an animating organ sort of thing of its own. It is the life force energy circulating in your body. And if it starts to lose its vitality, the cardiovascular system becomes sick. So what's going on with this? What I tell people about preeclampsia, and I'll get to the aspirin thing in a second. Let's start with aspirin. Aspirin works by causing a relative vasodilation of your blood vessels. And fine. The problem with preeclampsia, as we think, is that the placenta, which is a sort of convergence of blood vessels from mom and from baby, that serves as the life support system of the baby. It's where baby gets the oxygen and the nutrients and everything from mom. There's no other way for the baby to get it. So a healthy placenta leads to a healthy, well-growing baby, adequate fluids. If the placenta becomes sick, which happens in preeclampsia, which is why when you develop preeclampsia, you're immediately going to be doing NSTs and growth ultrasounds to make sure that the placenta is not sick. Preeclampsia leads to sick placenta, leads to small babies. That's the model. That's what we're all worried about. And if we give you aspirin, it seems to decrease the risk, if you have some risk, a variety of risk factors, the risk of you developing that vasculopathy. Mm-hmm. Now, preeclampsia used to be called toxemia in pregnancy. So there was somebody out there who sensed this is a sick person all of a sudden. It's not just a sick placenta. It's not just a sick heart. It's somebody who looked at it holistically and said, this entire something about this human form is now ill. It's like there's a toxin circulating. And so we projected that into the future and we said, well, the toxins must be coming from the placenta. And we started looking at cytokines and all this stuff. And it hasn't led us too far, but it doesn't have to be exclusive from what I'm talking about as blood being an animating force. Mm-hmm. So when I think about preeclampsia, I think again back to the liver. There's something wrong with this interface between the outside and the inside world, such that are developing this toxic sort of experience in the blood. And that is leading to a pathology in the cardiovascular system, including the placenta, which is a big old bag of blood and blood vessels. So aspirin probably does work for some people. It does probably work for some people for the purpose of preventing them from having preeclampsia so early that we have to eject the baby from the uterus early. Because for whatever reason, the baby now isn't getting that life force from the blood of the mom. Yeah. So we have a arrested development, so to speak, of the baby. And it may be better in that case for the baby to come out versus in. If aspirin can reduce that risk, because we don't have time to shore up all of these other things that contribute to the life force that is circulating through you and your baby, then so be it. But I will, again, it's kind of like the hyperemesis patient. I will treat them as if they have a liver disease and we have to cleanse their liver so their liver can do a better job of cleansing this living plasma, which is which is, you know, blood is not water, it's plasma, it's structured mm-hmm. water, and it has to be circulating in just the right way in order to animate the heart. And so there are other things that I will do if people have high risk of preeclampsia. I had a woman come to me. She had had a history of 2 C-sections. The first was at 35 weeks for HELLP syndrome, which is hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. That is multi-organ failure. You're going to die unless we get your baby out, which is why she had a C-section at 35 weeks. The second time, she developed severe preeclampsia requiring magnesium sulfate and had a C-section at 36 weeks. And this time, she wanted a vaginal birth. So she came to my house with her partner. They sat down, and the first thing we did was I brought out a can of smoked oysters, and I sat it in front of her with some Siete lime-flavored Siete chips. And I said, we're going to eat these. You're going to have some. Joel, you're going to have some. Let's do this. And we had a snack. And they were like, we don't really like these. You know. And I was like, let's just try it. Just try it. And they sucked them down. They did their, you know, their thing. This is like Crown Prince smoked oysters. It's actually pretty good when you, again, acquire the taste. But the reason I did that is I started realizing – that there are certain nutrients that are relevant to the fertility process, selenium, manganese, molybdenum, magnesium, zinc, copper, these types of things also seem, L-arginine, I mean, these types of things actually seemed to improve fertility. And when my clients were, you know, were taking these different multivitamins from nature, including the beef liver, they weren't developing these issues. And then I read about, it was actually Michelle O'Donnell had introduced this topic to me of the aquatic ape theory, which proposes that humans, given that we used to live on shorelines and we're eating a lot of shellfish, are now living in inland and we're eating agricultural products and we're developing chronic diseases for a variety of reasons. I mean, you could, there's a whole bunch of issues with our farmlands, but just by virtue of them not eating bivalves like clams, mussels, and oysters, which would have been pretty darn easy to eat in high volumes when we lived on shorelines, you just go out there and pluck it and open it up and you eat it. By virtue of us not eating bivalves, that we potentially are seeing a lot of these chronic illnesses evolve. And there's something to that, because when a person eats these types of foods, especially bivalves, and I like mussels, they're my favorite, or oysters, they're my favorite, but clams and mussels also work, you actually get a lowering of blood pressure and an overall better function of the liver. And I think it's because of the micronutrient content that you generally can't get in a lot of other ways. So nature's multivitamins, liver cleanse before your next pregnancy, adequate protein, you can supplement with L-arginine, you can supplement with magnesium. Those are things that can help prevent it. And if you have multiple risk factors and you don't want to do those things, pop a baby aspirin. It's probably going to be helpful and very, very unlikely to be harmful.
Mm-hmm. Mm, I like that. I noticed that you were talking about her spouse having to eat that food too. Did you want to touch on anything to do with his impact on placenta health and how maybe he should come along with the nutrition journey?
I think you're leading me to say that a man actually has some role in the health of the pregnancy. And I absolutely think that that's true. I think that when we look at, you can call it epigenetics or whatever, but the health of that sperm and the contents of the genetic material, the fragmentation or lack thereof of the genetic material inside the sperm meeting the genetic material inside the egg is going to make the baby. And so you have already programmed your, so to speak, your genetic material, this blueprint, in order to develop either a healthy placenta and fetal unit or a suboptimal placental and fetal unit. So I like to get people started on that way before pregnancy. In that case of that couple, if she's going to do it, you're going to do it. And you guys need to be in this together. So there actually is a shoulder-to-shoulder arrangement that I work hard on with my couples, which is probably the most important element that's being missed in most health coaching. Like, this is not your issue or your issue. This is your combined effort here that is going to lead to, or, you know, either make or break this birth. And what happened with their birth? They went into labor at 40 weeks, or it was actually like 41 weeks. They had a very, very short, you know, from my standpoint, a very easy labor process. She ended up giving birth to a surprise breech baby and never developed any high blood pressures. She was perfectly healthy after 2 prior pregnancies that were complicated by severely high blood pressures, including HELLP syndrome. So this stuff is real. It works, but you have to be willing to do the work. There's nobody who's going to save you from this if you're not willing to do it yourself. And frankly, I don't know if they had said we're not willing to eat oysters. I might have said I'm not going to be your doctor. Mm-hmm. I believe in this so much, and it's not a belief. It's not like a new religion. It's this is what works. it just does. And yeah. If it doesn't, we'll fine tune it a little further. But you have to be willing to invest in yourself and love yourself in this way if you want a good outcome. You're not entitled to have that beautiful home birth that you see on Instagram. All that you're entitled to do is to make the right choices to treat your body like a temple in order to, again, improve the odds of you not having that bad thing happen.
Mm-hmm. That's a hard one to swallow, you know, because it's so much easier, again, to try and lay blame elsewhere or, you know, I just didn't know enough or I didn't take the right supplements or I need a supplement, you know, and... You know, there's some nasty things I have to eat sometimes for my health. And it's like, you know what? Get a good chaser.
Yeah, right.
It's just got to happen. I do value your time, so I don't want to keep you much longer. But I do have one last question I would love to touch on.
Sure.
And that is epidurals, because that was asked a lot. And I personally am really scared of needles. So
everyone was
like, why did you decide to do, you know, XYZ? And I'm like, well, I am so scared of needles that it kind of like overwhelmed any other fear that I had. So there was that. But a big question is why I know some women fight so hard to have a birth without an epidural. You know, they prepare for it mentally, you know, emotionally and physically. And that's just what they want. And then other ones choose that because of, you know, side effects that they may see from an epidural. And could you touch on, you know, why maybe you wouldn't want, or maybe you would want to choose to prepare yourself to not have one? Like, are there any side effects to you, to post-birth, postpartum, the baby, anything like that, that maybe we should know?
Well, let me remind everybody, I'm not an expert in childbirth. I've never had a baby. I will never know what it's like to be in labor. So what I'm about to say might be confronting for people. You know, us guys have it relatively easy from a very sort of materialistic way of looking at the human body. We don't have to have a period every month. And a lot of people would say like, oh, those pesky periods, you don't want to have that. Take a birth control pill, right? And I happen to be one of those people who is saying the opposite of that. Like, hey, maybe there's a reason that you're having these cycles every month. And even if it does prevent you from getting pregnant, or it does, you know, suppress your PMS symptoms and whatnot, perhaps there's a reason energetically that you have to cleanse that out every single month. So procreation happens in the womb. It's the center of creative expression. And the act of growing and then giving birth to a baby is like really the ultimate expression of your creative potential as a human being. In menopause, I've recently started, you know, considering male menopause as kind of related to like the prostate. Like the prostate just keeps growing and growing, and there's nowhere for that energy to go. And now you have this like prostate is growing out of control. Well, likewise, in menopause, you have this expression. It's a bubbling over of some sort of creative force, which is pretty gnarly, I'm sure, for many women. Well, what if you were suppressing your periods every single month for 30 years on birth control, and then you go through menopause? I don't know if this has been studied, but I suspect that women who have not cycled through every moon for 12 to 13 times per year for their 35 years of reproductive age, that they are going to have a worse menopause than women who actually have connected with those cycles and gone through the, if you want to call it suffering, or if you want to call it embracing the gift, whatever you want to call it, I'm not going to give anybody individual language, but I suspect that menopause is going to be harder for those individuals who suppressed ovulation and cycling for all those years. Now, birth, I can't tell you how many times I have heard two things. One is that they had an epidural for their first two births, and their third one, they went natural. And while it was very empowering, it was so much more gnarly than they expected. I don't know what to say about that. I don't think anybody has to suffer. But if you can reframe this as work that your body is doing, similar to your menstrual cycles and the cramping and whatnot, pain periods should not be like debilitatingly painful. I will say that. But if you've allowed your body to go through this energetic cleansing process, after all those years of menstruating, menopause is maybe easier. If you permit yourself to go through the rite of passage in which death is on the line, energetically, not physically, fortunately for many women, but if you are able to walk through the fire and to assume the virtues of a rite of passage, then you're able to transform through that. But there's no bypassing any rite of passage. And if birth is a medical procedure, then go and do this medical, you know, the stuff. Get the epidural and do all that. Watch Netflix and then a baby comes out. Hooray. But the other thing I've heard so much of is that when women have gone through the natural, you know, I don't like the word physiologic, but the natural rite of passage that is childbirth, sometimes, oftentimes, they will say something like, I feel like I am a new woman and I am more powerful than ever. And it's not just because it was painful and they got through it. They managed to suffer through the pain. It was something about surrendering to the experience and trying to reframe from a nervous system standpoint what was happening, such that when they got to the precipice and they're facing mortality itself, I've heard that a lot, felt like I was dying, that they, instead of coming backwards and getting away from the edge, they actually jumped off like you're bungee jumping. And there's some power that resulted from that surrender that ended up resulting in a healing experience. I don't think it felt good in the moment, but it was sort of that exaltation of having believed in themselves and standing on their own two feet and letting it roar. There's something mysterious and beautiful about that. And women who have had free births or home births or even unmedicated hospital births oftentimes will say that was very empowering and healing. They're not like, it was terrible. The women who say that are the women who actually had the epidural. So there was something there. There's a difference there in the psyche and how the psyche approaches a rite of passage that I think is really important. And I think that's kind of the next frontier for us to understand this. So I know that I did my thing there, but an epidural is probably safe from the standpoint of, like, are you going to get an infection? Unlikely. Are we going to puncture the dura and you end up with a spinal headache? Unlikely. Are you going to end up paralyzed? Extremely unlikely. The spinal cord is kind of floating. It would be like trying to pop a balloon that's half deflated in your room with a pencil, like a blunt pencil. Like, you can poke it and it moves out of the way. That's how the spinal cord is. It's not pinned down such that a needle, which is super small gauge, is just going to pierce you and then paralyze you from the neck down. It doesn't work like that. Will I say it's never happened? No, because I'm sure that there are certain situations in which you do have maybe a constriction around a part of the spinal cord and it is tethered and then you hit it and you can do damage. But I think most women who are worried about, like, you know, oh, I have back pain because I got an epidural. Like, no, you had back pain because you probably have poor posture and you've probably maintained that poor posture throughout pregnancy, before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and afterwards when you're holding a baby in one arm. You probably also got nursemaid's elbow and you probably had all that stuff because nobody actually taught you or gave you the space and created an environment where you can actually sit comfortably and hold your baby. And you were expected to get on a train with your baby and go to work 6 weeks after with your baby. And of course your back is hurting because your center of gravity went from here to here in a matter of moments and nobody actually talked to you or helped you recover and lie in that immediate postpartum period. So epidurals are probably okay. They can cause a transient drop in your blood pressure, which can lead to some emergency situations in the hospital setting. Those are fairly common. The anesthesiologist will usually run in and give you some epinephrine to boost your blood pressure up while you equilibrate. Somebody will raise your feet and then you get back to laboring, I suppose. But I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. I think if you're feeling intuitively like, I think I need the epidural, you may have already gone through that rite of passage for this pregnancy and you may have now surrendered to needing help. That might be a part of your contract as well. Like, when are you going to just ask for help? That might be a part of your lesson as well. So there's not a right or wrong way to do this. But when you hear people's birth stories, I'm often surprised by what their experience was like. And some people have great, totally medicated births, and some people have terrible unmedicated births. Everybody's story is going to be different. But I can't impress upon you the importance of getting your physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health in way before pregnancy, because all of this other stuff actually becomes a lot, I don't want to say easier, but it becomes a little bit more clear what your path will be when you've done your best job to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. I like the word rite of passage. I think pregnancy and labor is just a whole, it's a whole thing. Like, it's a whole thing. I always, you know, you feel so connected to your body, but so disconnected at the same time. And everything is so different and everything is changing. And, you know, your reality is completely changing. And your hormones are fluctuating. So your emotions are all over the place. And I always look at pregnancy as a marathon in terms of I have to prepare for it. You know, I have to prepare for labor physically. I have to prepare for it emotionally. I have to prepare for it mentally. Otherwise, there's no way I'm going to be able to, you know, have the type of labor that I'm hoping to. I have to set myself up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'll just piggyback on that for like 15 seconds. You, the listener, have probably become conditioned to handing over the responsibility of hard things to other people for your most of your life. And that's a part of the American culture. You know, we oftentimes have become so accustomed to giving away our power that we realize that when we start taking that power back, there's a lot of responsibility that emerges, but there's also an incredible source of power there. When you are going to finally just say, you know what, I'm doing it my way. And that may not be as you know, the ideal home environment and whatnot that a billionaire can afford. But if you can just do one little thing, like say no thank you, or eat a little bit of organ meat from a local butcher, even if it isn't from the best cow in the world, it's certainly better than eating a bunch of like fast food. When you do those tiny little things and you start to feel how your decisions have made your body operate differently and your mind operate differently and your sex life feels different, like there is incredible power there. And I just can't repeat this enough or encourage this enough, that you are ultimately the one who has to own the outcomes of your birth. You are co-creating this experience, whether you like it or not. And whatever you can do, even if it's small, tiny little changes, it's going to be for the betterment of your child's long-term health, your relationship's long-term health, your own well-being for the rest of your years here. So do your best.
Yeah, that's all you can ask. Well, can you tell me where the people can find you and learn more about all the things?
Yeah, belovedholistics.com is my website. Everything is now there, including my programs like the Born Free Method, which is my very comprehensive preconception all the way through postpartum program. It's a self-guided tour, lifetime access. We cover absolutely everything. This was like 1% of what's covered in the program. So it is really, really a beautiful program with weekly calls, over 350 citations. We have guest speakers come in all the time, like really high profile guest speakers. And it is my beloved community with Sarah Rosser, who was until recently one of the farm midwives. And it is our pride and joy. So everything that you can find that I do is at belovedholistics.com. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Balancing Hormones Naturally. If you found this helpful, I would love for you to share it with a friend and post it on your stories and tag Balancing Hormones Naturally podcast so we can get this message out. You can find me on Instagram at Leah_BRUEG, and I would absolutely love to hear from you.